So I want to say a little bit about forgiveness, which deserves more than a little bit. And we'll do another sitting, and then there'll just be time for questions and discussion. So obviously this is a very intense word, which can mean many different things for many different people. As my friend Sylvia Borstein, one of my colleagues, once put it, I always thought very well. She said, forgiveness is not amnesia. It's also not discounting maybe the gravity of the harm caused, or either by us or by someone else, or trying to pretend it's other than what it genuinely seems to have been. But it's more a sense of either acknowledging a bigger picture of life, which includes, if not definite change, then at least the possibility of change, which is always inherent in life. So for example, when I try to understand a term like forgiveness or anger, I usually start just by applying it to myself. And that becomes my laboratory for trying to understand more dimensions and nuances of that state. So I would start with, what does it mean to forgive myself? And somehow, I don't even know how I began doing that, but that helps me have a more comprehensive understanding of the state. And then, of course, once applied to myself, I can imagine applying it to others. So what does it mean to forgive myself? It doesn't seem to mean pretending that whatever it was didn't happen. It does seem to mean losing a kind of fixation, a complete identification of myself with that one act or set of behaviors. So that's what I mean by a bigger picture. Having just a more comprehensive sense. It also, forgiveness also means, in a way, it's like recapturing some energy that has been held hostage by the past or another person or something we've done, you know, so that there's been a real, it's almost like a condensation or constriction of one's energy and difficulty flowing on in some way. In Buddhist monastic circles, there's almost like a ritual of forgiveness that's done that I find interesting, because I think it points to some of the nature of that state, which again doesn't mean pretending it didn't matter what happened or doesn't still matter. It's something very different. It's about being willing to imagine new beginnings. So, for example, this Burmese teacher, Sayadaw Pandita, came to IMS in Barrie in 1984 and taught a three-month retreat. And this was his first trip to the United States, and many of the people who are most familiar with monasticism were actually doing the retreat, so we're not able to be involved in what was going on day to day. And his, Upandita's, particular interpretation of the rules, as you can tell, if, you know, lunch is in his monastery is at 10:30 in the morning, and then you can't even have tea or coffee after that, it's very strict. In some Thai forest monasteries, it's a little complicated, but in the Buddha's time, when the monastic rules were laid out, and you weren't supposed to eat solid food after noon, there was an exception made for certain things, like if you were sick or you had really bad digestion, you could have ghee and sesame oil and molasses and something else. So in Upandita's monastery, they have those four substances, whatever the fourth is, and they mix them together into this really horrific tasting paste. And that's the only thing you can have afternoon. And some Thai forest monasteries somehow, I don't know, it's like ghee, which is, you know, clarified butter, has become cheese. And a bunch of the others have become dark chocolate. So you're allowed to have dark chocolate and cheese afternoon. And I always thought, well, anyone could live on dark chocolate and cheese afternoon. How come I ended up in Burma? You know, like, it is hard. Anyway, so there's Upandita, very strict, you know, in the States for the first time. And there I was sitting as a retreatant, silent, and I could just tell, you know, there was a lot of stress in the system, that things were not often, or often things were kind of awry, and there was some kind of problem. For one thing, he kept moving where he was sleeping, and I thought, that's odd, you know? And I sat for 3 months, and much to my surprise, at the end of the retreat, he just got up, and as a way of closing the retreat formally, he said, if I have hurt or harmed you knowingly or unknowingly, I ask your forgiveness. And if anyone has hurt or harmed me knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive them. And it was really kind of an incredible moment, because I realized, even though he and I had had a wonderful personal relationship, that I did, once he said that, I thought, oh, I don't have to then think, oh, if I go to study with you in Burma, you're going to look at me and think, oh, you're the one who started the center, you know, where they don't even know how to treat monastics. And I wouldn't look at him and think, well, you're the one who, you know, came to IMS and you weren't prepared for the West. And it was like, okay, we're going to start anew. And I thought, what an interesting kind of ritual. And, you know, the other side of this movement toward forgiveness is that it's not compulsory. You don't have to think of it as coercive. You don't have to force yourself to feel a certain thing. But if you want to, you can set the stage for seeing what it's like when you make, again, it's like an experiment with yourself, with others. And this, of course, ties into loving kindness for a difficult person. When we offer loving kindness to a difficult person, first of all, in the system of practice, they suggest you not start with the person who has just hurt you so badly, or the person who's behaved just so horribly on the world stage that it's almost unimaginable. It's not that we never go there, but again, there are a lot of questions that are being explored, not necessarily analytically, but through our experience. What does it mean to have compassion for someone and not give in to what they're doing or asking? What does it mean to have compassion for someone and have like a really firm set of boundaries? What does it mean to balance compassion for oneself and compassion for others? So experientially, this is the terrain we're going through. And if you start with just this like kind of nearly unimaginable person, it's very hard. You know, we get discouraged, it's overwhelming, we don't have time to kind of go through that whole journey and build confidence and clarity. You know, so it's like doing something in the hardest way possible. I find that many people, including myself, like to do that anyway. That it doesn't feel like it counts, you know, if it's just like an annoying coworker, when it could be this real... And, you know, in the translation, the old-fashioned translation of the term from Pali is enemy. You know, so that's even more intense. It's like it could be this real enemy, but you're just using this obnoxious person. And yet, one of the things about loving kindness practice is that it does demand a lot of creativity and a free flow of energy. So, for example, even with a mildly difficult person, if it's too difficult, go back to loving kindness for yourself. That's not a cop-out, that's not the wrong thing to do, that is the right thing to do. because you're just trying to explore this whole world, this whole terrain. Sometimes people with a difficult person will imagine themselves with them and in effect be saying, may we be happy, may we be peaceful, see what happens then. Those visualizations I mentioned yesterday, imagine this person as an infant, imagine them dying, just see what happens in your own mind. But again, none of this is like forced or demanding of yourself. It's really taking a big interest in your own experience and what's actually possible. I thought, oh, those birds came just in time. Maybe happy. So do you have any questions or comments about anything before we close? Yes. We have to thank you profusely for all that running around. Actually, I think it makes it a different practice. It makes it more like an affirmation, which I've never really done, so I can't speak as to the nature of doing that practice. But I think that's a switch that actually changes the practice. So, I don't know. I mean, you know, the may I or may you is a little funny as a construction for us. It can sound a little imploring or begging or pleading, and it's not meant to be that. You know, as I often quote Sylvia Boorstein, who said it was the hortatory subjunctive part of speech, and she said it's like you hand someone a birthday card and you say, may you have a happy birthday. You know, may you have a great new year. That's kind of the energy of it, which is different than I am happy, I am peaceful, I'm successful, you know, so I couldn't really say what the effect of that is. Yeah.
I found myself coming in out of the mundane or rote. So can you speak to that? And you also like, can you please ask a pepper if you
So could you hear? The comment was about finding herself coming in and out of being rote or mundane, like as though she were saying, could you please pass the pepper, could you please pass the pepper, you know. Definitely that can happen. Just as with too much tranquility compared to the amount of energy in one system, the phrases can get really garbled and weird. Without a real sense of aim, the phrases can get sort of rote and meaningless. So. There are two different avenues that are used. One is really working with the sense of aim. It's like as though you say to yourself, just this one phrase. If you were with the breath, it would be as though you were saying to yourself, just this one breath. You know, and so there's a kind of sense of a precise aim. In the teachings and the psychology, it's called right aim. And the example that's generally used is imagine a piece of food on a plate, and in your hand you're holding a fork. Let's say a piece of broccoli on a plate, and in your hand you're holding a fork with a rather obvious goal of connecting just deeply enough with the fork and the piece of broccoli so you can lift it and eat it. So this example, as simple as it is usually used to describe, you can almost say, the technical side of these kinds of meditations. We have an object of the present moment. We need to aim our attention right at it, just like we take that fork and we aim it right at the broccoli. If the fork is kind of waving around in the air, we're not going to get a lot of dinner. So it's like... and then the next thing we need actually is a careful and sensitive modulation of our energy. If there's too little energy, then the fork just hangs there in our hand. Whereas if there's too much energy, it's like we take the fork and we bash it through the broccoli and everything goes flying. So as simple as it is, almost simplistic, that example holds a lot about how we practice. We have an object of the present moment. It might be a phrase of metta, it might be a breath, it might be a sensation in the body. We aim our attention toward just this one moment's experience, and we simply connect. And so that's part of it, that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, what I was talking about a little bit yesterday is that, if it doesn't make you too agitated or restless or lost in thought, there are ways definitely that people try to get creative in making the phrases more meaningful. You know, maybe they reflect on the person, the being, who's the recipient, some, and the good within them, or the fact this being also wants to be happy, or even just having a stronger sense of that being, or reflect, not analytically, but feel your way into what happiness might look like, or peace, or safety, or whatever. And again, you know, there's like a balance. You have to see for yourself in your own mind if it just becomes a huge amount of discursive thinking or not. You know, if it seems to just enliven the practice and make it more real.
Hello. Could you talk a little bit about the phrases in relation to action? Sometimes I find myself in situations where I'm using the phrases and I'm thinking, well, it seems to be too easy, I should be doing something. Like a simple example was a dog kind of running on the loose while I was walking by a really busy street and saying, maybe safe, maybe safe. But then I also went and tried to get the dog to go back to its home. There are other situations where sometimes it seems so easy to just say the phrases.
Mm-hmm.
But
the
situation seems to call for action.
Did you hear that? I'm not sure. Obviously, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, and I'm not sure in what circumstance they would seem mutually exclusive. You know, if it's a circumstance where we feel kind of helpless and we're not sure what to do, and so we resort to just doing the phrases, and that's not a bad thing, because at least we are affirming a sense of connection. Or it might be, you know, we have a kind of timidity or super judgmental attitude about action, and so we think, well, I did my part, you know, I said some phrases, and that's cool. You know, so I suppose there are different scenarios where we'd set them apart and think that, well, the phrases have to be enough because I'm not going to pursue it, or I can't pursue it into action. Or then there's just certain real-time, real-life situations where you don't have a clue what to do. And so by doing the phrases, we are at least being present with, rather than avoiding or denying or looking the other way, and we don't know what will arise from that. Um, if you think of the metta practice, for example, as that transformation of intentionality, then it shouldn't necessarily affect whether we do something or not do something, but more affect where we're coming from as we do something. You know, and so even if one is postponing action, I suppose one could say, well, that's a pretty radical transformation. So any action I take would be coming from such a different place. Or maybe it's not that at all. Maybe you say, I'm not postponing action, but I'm still working on coming from a different place. So for example, I taught, it was one of the early times I ever taught a non-residential loving kindness weekend in New York City, might even have been the first. And so we did all our walking meditation just on the streets of New York. And somebody came in after walking and said that he'd gone out and he was doing his loving kindness practice, and a homeless person came up to him and asked him for a dollar. And he said that it actually was his practice, not formal meditation practice, but it was his tendency to give the dollar. That's just what he did in his life. And so he said, I just reached into my wallet to do what I always do. And he said, but this was the first time I ever looked a person like that in the eye and realized that was a human being. You know, so that was the difference. So it's kind of on that level, I think. Yeah.
Yesterday you mentioned that we're all just a phone call away from somebody. It would seem that equanimity is a good preparation for that. So I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about how to apply that equanimity after the phone call.
We get those phone calls, don't we? I think some of it is real understanding, to realize that equanimity doesn't mean not feeling anything, so you don't have to feel badly about reactions, you know, and even intense reactions, and think, well, I should be calmer or, you know, cooler or have a different perspective. It's not like that. So it's the first thing, is giving yourself enough space to be with what is. And then I think just the general training one has in mindfulness allows one to see more and more how we might take a very difficult or painful situation and add on to it. So we kind of see that tendency. And because of that wisdom, you know, we can let go of that. So, you know, for example, there's, I think, not just in terms of personal conditioning, in terms of cultural conditioning, there's a huge imperative we have to deny suffering, to feel isolated, to feel alone, to hide it, to ask others to hide theirs, you know, because it's all kind of bothersome. You know, we get that message quite a lot. And so very often that arises in a really difficult, and especially an abruptly difficult situation. But if we can see it for what it is, we can work to let go of that and not either isolate or have others more isolated, and have a different sense of things. So for example, somebody came to see me once who'd had a horrible, horrible, horrible traumatic thing happen in her family. And she told me, I don't know, maybe it had been 6 months before or close to a year, but not a vast amount of time. And she said to me, My friends are kind of intimating it's time to get over it. And, I mean, I just looked at her and I thought, ooh, not everyone, you know, ever gets over the kind of thing that happened to you. And then she said, my friends all have golden lives. They're perfect lives. And I'm now like their worst nightmare to see what can happen. And she said, their lives are just perfect. Which, first of all, I didn't believe for a moment, you know. Because a lot happens behind closed doors. And then I had one of those experiences, you know, where you just hear these words come out of your mouth. So what I heard come out of my mouth was, I think you need new friends. I said, you should meet my friends. They're all a wreck. You know, everyone's got something going on that's like really bad one way or another. I often have friends in the room when I tell that story. I think, I wonder what they're thinking right now. You know, but it's true. That's actually the truth of things, not this image, you know, of total perfection and so on. And so think about the disadvantage we all are at when, you know, we have somehow bought into that image. And so that's the kind of thing we see. Just those waves of conditioning arise. And through the force of the mindfulness, we can kind of say, okay, I don't need that. You know, I know where that goes. I'm going to look for something much more authentic or much more genuine in this moment. You know, so it's things like that, really.
I had this experience where at one point there was this arising of this tremendous resistance. And it was almost like obstinance, it was sort of angry. And I tried to keep practicing through that and sending out wishes, and it just felt very, just not genuine, and I didn't want to be sending that out. Mm-hmm. It's not how I want to feel. And so I noticed that, and then just returned to practicing for myself. But then that became sort of a project, like you were saying earlier, of, okay, now I'm doing this so I can get in a place where I feel better, so I can be genuine and send this out. And I was very stuck. I didn't really know where to go, and I finally just dropped it.
Mm-hmm.
I just was noticing how my body was reacting to that all the time. So I guess my question is how to work with that. Is there a time to kind of keep pursuing it no matter what's arising, or is there a time to let it come?
Well, you know, I think just like when I said, let's say you're very sleepy and there are lots of different things you might try one after another, and it's all okay. You know, if the first one doesn't really bring more balance, you try another one. Second one doesn't bring more balance, you try another one. So I think you did exactly the right sequence. You know, classically in metta practice, they'd say, okay, this other thing arises. The first thing is see if you can have it be in the background and just keep going. Maybe you can't. You know, it's just too strong, it's too oppressive, it's taking up too much space. So then the thing to do is send loving kindness to yourself, because you're the one who's sitting there suffering in some way from that. And maybe that doesn't work either to bring more balance, so then you just pay attention in as warm and loving a way as you can to the experience as it happens. You know, there's also a place in there where I could see the possibility of your sending loving kindness to yourself, seeing the thought that you're doing this so you can work it out so that you're in a better place, so your loving kindness is more effective, and kind of dissolving that thought and just coming back to the loving kindness for yourself from a different space. But if that doesn't happen or it doesn't bring balance, then what you described is exactly right. It's just be with that experience. I mean, I almost feel like... In learning a practice like loving kindness and all the components of equanimity that are wrapped in there, or wisdom that are wrapped in there, we then have a set of tools and we can see how they apply in different situations, especially if you have confidence in the tools and what to expect. If you don't have, as many people don't, a realistic idea of what to expect, then it's very self-punishing. You know, like, oh, damn it, I didn't feel love within the first 15 minutes, or if I concentrate on the breath, I shouldn't have any thoughts because no one else in the room has any thoughts. And, you know, I've been practicing for an hour and a half and I still have thoughts. And, you know, those things are unrealistic. Like, we will still have thoughts, and as does everyone else. And we may not have this pristine, extraordinary state of a certain feeling, but the practice is still working. You know, but once we have that kind of understanding, which I'm calling clarity and confidence, then we really can play and utilize the tools in lots of different ways. People say, I have this issue, can I send that loving kindness? And you think, yeah, why not? You know, or I tell the story sometimes about how years ago, this was like, even though I don't really remember the 90s, I can remember this, 1993 or 4, let's say somewhere in there, because I know the date because I was working on my first book, which was Loving Kindness, and I didn't know how to use a computer. Not everyone had a computer in those days. I certainly didn't have a computer, and I was quite convinced I could never learn how to use a computer, that it was beyond me. So in those days, cutting and pasting meant taking a pair of scissors and cutting and moving the paragraph around the piece of paper and then taking some scotch tape and pasting it. So that's how I was working on loving kindness. And one day at IMS, there was a retreat going on, and we had a visitor who was a 94-year-old monk from Sri Lanka. And we had just a little small gathering together, and he mentioned in that gathering that he was learning how to use a computer. So I thought, wow, he's 94 and he feels he can learn how to use a computer. I bet I can learn how to use a computer. So I went and got one. That's how I can place it. But anyway, he said he wanted to give a talk in the hall to the retreatants there. So we thought, well, 94, you know, like, maybe it'd be like 20 minutes, half an hour, something like that. So he went into the hall. He turned out to have like 10,000 times more energy than any of us. He gave a talk for hours, you know. And he led this guided loving kindness meditation through the body. Like, may my head be happy. May my ears be happy. May my eyes... And he just went down through the body, and I thought, maybe that's why he has all that energy. You know, and you may not find that particular kind of meditation, you know, in a text or something like that, but it's like an adaptation. And how interesting, you know, just to see, wow, what happens when I do that? You know, and I do that, and I do that, and transform my relationship to that, and that, and that. So it's quite fun, you know, in that way.
Before we go, thank you so much for what you've given us this weekend. Before we finish for the day, could you give us a sneak peek into your book?
Oh, my book. My book is a source of a lot of suffering right now. If it gets done in time, in terms of the final edits, and time is soon upon us, I just found out, then it will come out in late January. That is actually somewhat uncertain at this point, but let's assume all goes well. Originally the book was going to be called Why Meditate, so it's really about that. It's got some of the science in it, it's got sort of basic principles of concentration, mindfulness, loving kindness, and then there's this big how-to section. So it's become like a 28-day program of practice. You know, and I always write these things thinking that what if someone doesn't have a teacher or doesn't have a community or can't ask questions? You know, let me try to lay it out in a way that could be really useful. And somebody asked me if I thought it would be helpful for people more experienced in meditation. I said, well, I always hope that. But I think even if not, you know, if you've got that friend who you've always wanted to turn on to meditation, and you think, okay, here's a way. But I hope it will be helpful for all kinds of people. The book is no longer called that. This is why I keep thinking, what's it called? Do you know Matthew Ricard? He's a French person, extraordinary person, who's a monk in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. So anyway, I got an advanced copy of his book to write an endorsement for. It was called My Meditate. So I was recently on a stage with him in Madison, Wisconsin, with the Dalai Lama, but the Dalai Lama hadn't come yet. So I looked at Matthew and I said, you stole my book title. So then after it couldn't be called Why Meditate, I said to the publisher, let's call it Why Not Meditate. But they didn't like that. So it's called something about happiness now. Maybe Real Happiness, something like that. It's actually quite a nice cover. If only the content were ready, it would be a book. But if all goes well, I'm happy about it. I think it's an exciting thing. And I will go on a book tour if it does come out in January. I'll just go on a book tour in February. And then I have another book that I'm writing with this friend, Bob Thurman, on working with your enemies. So I don't mean working in the job, you know, but transforming that particular relationship. So. But I can't really get to that until I finish this. So that's my book story.
Hello.
Hi.
I was hoping you could talk about both the idea that we can harm people or cause suffering, and also the idea that everybody is responsible for their happiness or their unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
For me, they often seem contradictory.
Uh-huh. I think they can certainly seem contradictory. Partly the way we can harm people. It's definitely not meant to be contradictory. Part of the way we harm people, it begins with the way we harm ourselves when we act from certain places. You know, we're overcome by greed, we're overcome by anger, and we just act. And so the first person we harm is ourselves. And our actions definitely have an effect on others. You know, you steal from somebody, they're missing something. You lie to somebody, they enter some kind of confused realm. Even if they don't quite know it, usually there's something that's awry in the relationship, so there's kind of a feeling like something's off. And, you know, so people are definitely affected by our actions. When we do the reflection, when we do the phrases, all beings are the owners of their karma, their happiness and unhappiness depends upon their actions, it's not meant to imply our actions are inconsequential, but that we cannot ultimately determine someone's happiness and unhappiness because we're not in control. you know, so it's more almost in a sense of looking at an effort to help than the consequences of harm. You know, we want someone to stop drinking or stop lying themselves or whatever it might be. And it's not that our actions to make it so are completely meaningless or ineffectual, but ultimately we're not in control because we actually can't decide for that person how they're going to live. So our actions do have an effect, but maybe not always the effect we want in the time frame we want. We can't take over someone's life. We can't sort of live their life for them. And interestingly, the example that's used for equanimity very often in the Buddhist texts in that sense is a parent whose child is now an adult. And even though there's all of this loving kindness and compassion and caring and closeness, there also needs to be this recognition, like, I can't decide for them what they're going to do. I can't make those choices for them. A good deal of their happiness and unhappiness will depend on those choices, perhaps. But I need to let go because it's their life. It's not my life. You know, so it's interesting. It was interesting to me that that example was so often used in the Buddhist texts. And I used to think, well, what nice families they must have had. You know, everyone let go at the right time and, like, they all still care. You know, but that, I think it's a good example because it makes it clear. It's not a rejection. It's not like saying, I don't care what you do. You know, it's up to you. Like, there's still perhaps this tremendous love and connection and care, but there's the wisdom of knowing it's not up to me. So sometimes when I talk about equanimity, I see that one of my favorite words to use is a kind of poignancy. You know, it's not totally devoid of feeling, that state of equanimity. It is kind of poignant. Like, ooh, if I could just take over your head for one day, you know, things could be considerably better. But life's not like that. You know, so even as we come to peace with that, there's that, just that flavor. It's like, ooh, I wish I could. And it's not going to be that way. You know, so I think that's what the phrase really implies. And you would never, by the way, I think, I can't remember where I heard this, somebody said to me once, maybe it's from Tibetan teachings, clearly you would never look at somebody in a state of some distress, especially if you harm them in some way and say, well, it's just your karma, you know. You know, that's more a kind of liberating reflection than a communication to somebody, you know, to try to understand the vastness of things in some way. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned it's their life, not mine, you know, and to remind yourself of that. Let's say I'm thinking my own experience was you're in pain because you can't change things there. And I'm wondering, in your wisdom and the years that you've been investigating, if you might remind me of the very soothing ways, because you're left with the pain. And when you love somebody deeply, pain doesn't go away, even though it's often, and even though it's not there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it might be helpful to be reminded of the various ways, since it's my responsibility to soothe myself, you know, to just remind myself of some of the things that maybe I could use.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I think this is one of the places where people actually might do the phrases, and the phrases themselves are the action for that period of time, because you're, in doing the phrases, or whatever phrases one is using, It's like we're engaging in this world of connection rather than rejection, and also opening our hearts to the reality that is. We are left with the pain, it's true. But even in the midst of the pain, there is a kind of soothing, which is a good word, just from caring, and in that sense, not caring like, oh my God, you're hurting in this particular way and I can't change it, but like, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may this be part of your life someday, may this happen. And I think it does open us to a bigger reality. And also I think there's a way in which we can remind ourselves that life can be very mysterious. And we don't always know from the outside the simple joys or the moment-to-moment experience that someone might have. And so rather than be lost in that kind of categorization, I think it is very soothing and truthful to remind ourselves of the mysteries of life. Like, things are happening, you know, on so many different levels and so many different layers, and we don't know how one thing might lead to the next, and all these different changing circumstances. And then I think personally, actually, in a very real way, people build up a repertoire of ways of finding some relief. And those are very important. Because it's almost like in the teachings when they talk about the balance between compassion and sympathetic joy. It's like compassion helps us open to the suffering, and sympathetic joy helps us open to the joy. So for one thing, it's very hard to have sympathetic joy for someone else if you're not in touch with the joy in your own life. If you're in that state of like, I have nothing and I'm watching you get everything, it's not going to be that easy. You know, so one of the things we try to do is just in very simple ways tune into things we have to be grateful for. It could be the breeze. You know, it could be the fact that I'm not flying to Boston today when, you know, all the airports are closed down because of some storm. It doesn't have to be some huge, grandiose thing, but it's like, ooh, you know, we kind of remind ourselves of what we do have, and that's a very beautiful thing. And I think anybody who's in a situation of dealing a lot with suffering and pain, whether in a family or at work or, you know, within oneself, needs to feel okay about, first of all, taking care of themselves and seeing what it takes to have a bigger perspective about things so you're also tuning into some kind of joy. You know, so I did this project through the Garrison Institute, this place in New York State, for domestic violence shelter workers for like 4 or 5 years. We had these programs first with frontline workers and then directors and supervisors and finally executive directors, bringing tools of yoga and meditation to them, seeing what it was like. So needless to say, their days are extremely stressful and traumatic. And we would often start the different workshops when it was a new group of people by asking people, what do you do, you know, that gives you that sense of resiliency or happiness or openness? And a lot of people talk about music or nature or something like that. One person said, I watch American Idol. And I thought, oh my God, that makes me so tense. You know, like, who's going to lose? Like, I don't watch American Idol, you know, for relief. That wouldn't work. You know, but that's part of it, is understanding what we do. And then what was interesting in terms of watching the evolution, say, of a workplace in that way, was that the people themselves decided they wanted to create what they called a culture of wellness. And for everybody, that was something different. Some people said a rooftop garden, some people said this, some people said that. One woman said, and this was very illustrative, she said, I want to start taking a lunch break. And someone else said, you don't take a lunch break? You know, you're contractually allowed a lunch break. And she said, nope, I don't take a lunch break. So then she would start reporting in week after week on how it was going. And she, you know, one week she came in and she said, well, didn't really work because I locked the door. But somebody like bent down and looked through the keyhole to see if I was in there. And then they interrupted me. But then she came back the next week and she said, you know, it did work because I locked the door and turned out the lights. And then she had her lunch break. You know, but it takes a lot to kind of say, I deserve this. It's okay that I do this, that I keep creating the conditions where this can happen. But it's a very important thing. So that's part of it too. Yeah.
Lacerating self-hatred, mm-hmm. which is pretty strong, you know, cutting, suffering. Where do we start to deal with guilt?
You know, again, I think it's a part of the beginning is really feeling one's way into that distinction between guilt and remorse. And know that, I mean, remorse is also painful, but it's different. And then if you feel like you're just kind of consumed more by the state of guilt, they're actually, you know, doing a forgiveness meditation for yourself, reminding oneself about causes and conditions. Like, usually people don't wake up in the morning and think, I'm going to try to do that horrible thing today. You know, there are lots of causes and conditions that come into play. We might have a very different understanding now than we did then. The reality of change, which is not just make-believe, the constant reality of the possibility of change. So it's all of that. It's like reflections and understanding and forgiveness and realizing that even, you know, again, a lot comes back to beginning again. And even though it seems really silly sometimes and very mechanical, I think a lot happens just in the act of beginning again and beginning again and beginning again and beginning again. Even if it's something as simple as being with the breath, being distracted, and starting over and starting over, it's like we are changing something inside of us that reinforces our understanding that, oh yeah, I can begin again. I can begin again. And so, I mean, I've seen tremendous things around forgiveness happen, both of oneself and others, just through that. Because again, it's like almost like exercising a muscle, and then we can bring it to the big things, you know, having done it again and again with something small like that. So it's a lot like that. Okay. Yes, go ahead.
I'm always in protest. You said a lot, I think, that's going to help me with that. I'm always protesting this rising and falling. You know, I just want to swear, I just want to, I get angry. It always, it's doing so well, and then I'm like, oh, there it is again. And just, oh, you know, just the way life is. And I don't hear a lot of the word acceptance and Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Do I do a metta around this protesting that's always bumping up against the protest?
Mm-hmm. I just took the word acceptance out of my manuscript around 50 times. So you do actually hear a lot of it. One can hear a lot of it, but I think sometimes it's one of those words that's very hard to understand without, you know, a lot of thinking and background and stuff like that. Yes, metta is great. I think in relationship to that kind of pattern. And also, part of mindfulness is seeing patterns as patterns. And I'll close with this story, and then we'll end, which many of you know anyway from my book, Faith, where I was talking about a friend of ours on the East Coast once rented a house for several of us to come and do a retreat in. So when I went into the bedroom that had been set aside for me, there was a cartoon that had been left on the desk, and it was from the Peanuts comic strip. And in the first frame of the cartoon, Lucy is talking to Charlie Brown, and she says, "You know, Charlie Brown, what your problem is? The problem with you is that you're you." And then in the second frame, where Charlie Brown looks at her and says, "Well, what in the world can I do about that?" Then in the third and final frame, Lucy says, "I don't pretend to be able to give advice. I merely point out the problem." And somehow, whenever I was doing walking meditation by that desk, my eye would fall on that precise line, "The problem with you is that you're you." You know, because that had been a very familiar voice in my earlier life. And so, but the whole experience gave me this great mental note to utilize so that when I was, you know, something really good would happen and my first thought would be, "It's never going to happen again," I'd say, "Chill out, Lucy." Or, "Hi, Lucy." Or, you know, that sort of nagging, you know, if you really knew who you were, it would be this terrible problem and be like, "Oh yeah, Lucy, there you are." Which is the point. It's like that elderly person sitting in the playground watching children play. It's not to freak out like, "Oh my God, Lucy's back, I'm so horrible, all this has been fruitless," or, "Yes, Lucy's always right," you know, but it's like, "Oh yeah, I kind of see you, I know that." You know, so there is like all that kindness and yet all that space, even toward Lucy, you know, or toward whatever might happen. So we are really capable of a lot, just through the power of awareness.